Monster Man, special episode, science fiction monsters.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Robert. If you'd like to be like Robert and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to the $5 reward, your own special episode, you'll also get the rewards for lower levels, including occasional bonus content, which should be coming out pretty soon this month, and my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I talk about the Deities and Demigods supplement for AD&D First Edition and how to use religion and mythology in your fantasy RPGs. So, Robert, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Okay, so, when we ask ourselves what it means to bring a science fiction monster into a fantasy setting, we need to start by defining the boundary between fantasy and science fiction, which is a vexed question. We've already discussed this a little bit when we took a look at some other spacey monsters. So, for example, my special episode on classic Doctor Who monsters, or my special episode about alien abductions. I don't necessarily think that we need to define the boundary between fantasy and science fiction clearly. We just need to think, you know, what are the types of monsters that we find in science fiction narratives, so in science fiction stories and science fiction films and television, that we don't also find in fantasy. So a monster that is primarily like a combat challenge for the characters to fight is something that is equally found in both genres. And there can be an overlap with like a horror monster as well. So take Alien, which is very much a horror movie, but nonetheless, the way that the xenomorph is discussed is with the language of science and biology, with the kind of more science fictional concept of, you know, humanity encountering species that it doesn't understand, where there's no sense of the uncanny in Alien. It's a demystifying monster. So let's just say that we're interested in aesthetic and narrative differences rather than some kind of philosophical distinction. So monsters that don't have any occult trappings, monsters that are encountered with like ecology or psychology or sociology, you know, monsters where the PCs tend to, or the protagonists tend to encounter them with a sort of scientific mindset. Science fiction monsters maybe trade more on the sensation of the unfamiliar, not necessarily, but I would say that commonly fantasy draws on familiarities that are rooted in older myth or older literature. So dragons are things that we already have feelings about, but a horta is a mystery and is designed to be a mystery. You know, the point of a dragon is that you have already got strong feelings about what it means. The point of a horta is that you have to figure out what it means. That's a monster from Star Trek, by the way. So I thought I'd take a look at three possible types of science fiction antagonist or science fiction encounter. And all of these are essentially intelligent alien races or intelligent alien cultures, but they form very different types of narratives. So the first ones that I want to talk about are the Motis. The Motis are creatures from the novel The Mote in God's Eye by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. There was a sequel. It was released in the US under the title The Gripping Hand. In the UK, it was called The Mote Around Murchison's Eye. The US title is better. And I'm sure that we've encountered a fantasy version of these monsters at some point. There definitely were kind of unofficial miniatures made by Asgard miniatures called Trimotes, which are clearly Motis. Motis are a mammalian species with a bunch of like specific subtypes. So there are engineer Motis and there are diplomat Motis. And they vary in their reproductive capabilities. So, for example, the masters or ruling caste of the Motis are fertile, but they can become, at one phase in their reproductive cycle, they become sterile, at which point they become keepers who are entrusted with the long-term conservation of societal resources because they don't have offspring. And therefore, you know, the idea is that they won't be self-interested. They'll do it for the community as a whole. Now, a friend of mine many years ago described this book as The Keystone Anthropologists or The Three Stooges Make First Contact. And this brings up a common problem in scientific problem solving in science fiction. The society of the Motis is relatively complex, but it is understandable. A student who paid reasonably good attention in high school biology will find all of the concepts in The Mote in God's Eye familiar. And that's good. It makes the story accessible. But of course, in reality, the reproductive strategies of an entire species that had determined the shape of their civilization in such a way as to cause intractable problems, which they have. I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail. That's not what's important. But, you know, that would be something that, like, proper scientists would spend a long time dealing with. And indeed, we're expected to believe that the Modis have a terrible problem that results from their biology. They are also masters of genetic engineering to the point where they can create all these different subspecies, and yet they have not applied their mastery of biology to solving that problem, largely because of a kind of culturally ingrained fatalism, which comes from this cycle of overpopulation and collapse and overpopulation and collapse that they have because of their weird reproduction. Anyway, but my point is basically that the Moda God's Eye is in many ways a traditional science fiction adventure story with some kind of, like, this is not an endorsement of The Moda God's Eye as a novel, by the way. I think it has very severe weaknesses. But it is kind of one of the texts that people talk about when they talk about novels that are primarily about contact with an alien species. And so to have that kind of, like, first contact story, I think in a fantasy game you have a problem, which is that in The Moda God's Eye, the humans are encountering intelligent alien life for the first time. There are human settlements all over space, but they have not, up to this point, encountered an intelligent alien. And that obviously is simply something that's not going to happen in a fantasy game, particularly in a more modern form of, like, Dungeons & Dragons or whatever, where playing a non-human creature is half of the point. So we have to make the quote-unquote aliens not just not human, but, like, really pretty out there. And I think that extra-planar creatures provide the best kind of analogy. So, for instance, if the player characters found themselves, you know, in Mechanus and had to get something out of the Modrons and, like, therefore figure out the intricacies of Modron communication and of Modron society, then that would be more akin to this type of first contact narrative. The Arrival is another good example of this, where the attempt to understand an alien language illuminates a lot about our own attempts to understand one another and our own language. I haven't read the story, but although I think I have the book, but the film does something really rather clever, I think, embedding in its structure certain ideas about communication and the way that we communicate without speaking, but with language. I don't know. Anyway, that's a sidebar. I don't know. Anyway, that's a side point. It occurred to me while saying that, that because of the way in which a role-playing game is a unique form of communication, you could kind of do that kind of metatextual interaction in such a story, you know, where you had an alien society that essentially communicated through some type of role-playing. Always this is going to be an oversimplification of any kind of real-world cultural contact, right? Like, look at the many challenges in history that, you know, human individuals from the same culture, much less humans from different cultures, much less humans from very different cultures, have had in kind of trying to communicate with each other. And then apply that to a completely alien culture, obviously it would be a hugely complex and time-consuming problem and, you know, outside the scope of a role-playing game adventure. So we're going to get a kind of Star Trekification of these problems, right? Like in Star Trek, where issues are pointed at rather than explored because the format of a 45-minute television show just doesn't permit, like, an in-depth look at, you know, a particular challenge. It changes a little bit later on, but... And yet, the episodes that people recall fondly often are these kinds of simplified explorations. So, I mean, speaking of the mechanics of communication, look at, you know, Darmok, right? The one with, you know, Darmok and Jalard at Tanagra. That episode, like, if you think about it from a linguistic standpoint, breaks down immediately. But that doesn't matter because it invites you to think about people who communicate in different ways. So rather than attempting to simulate an entire, like, communication problem, what we're attempting to do is give the feeling of having this communication problem. And I think if you can do that, then this type of monster story can be really interesting. Although, monster is perhaps the wrong word. This means that Modrons might actually be a really good example, because Modron society is complex, but in some ways the rules of Modrons are relatively simple. So once you can deduce the principles of lawful neutrality, you can make a reasonably good job of predicting what lower-level Modrons are going to do. And, you know, you can then kind of solve the quote-unquote puzzle of Modron society. And everybody likes Modrons in the first place, right? They're aesthetically appealing, which is another feature of a good science fiction alien. Now, you don't want to do this Modi thing more than once unless that's what your game is about. And if that's what your game is about, you're probably not playing D&D, you're playing, you know, Star Trek Adventures. Switching from the problems of first contact to, well, I guess also the problems of first contact, but in a completely different way, let's talk about the alien invasion story. So, it's nice to have really weird aliens show up to cause chaos. Again, that probably means something extra planar. When I was thinking about this, the main story that I was thinking of was, of course, H.G. Wells' classic, The War of the Worlds. And The War of the Worlds is a very interesting type of story because although it provides a good deal of the background, you know, in terms of how the aliens arrive and what happens during the alien invasion, the protagonists don't have a lot of agency in that. Now, this is a feature of a lot of kind of science fiction from this era, and indeed maybe a lot of science fiction of many eras, which is that the whole point is the exploration of the situation, and sometimes the protagonist is simply the pair of eyes through which the reader gets to experience this, but Wells actually does more than that. But my point is that the protagonist having comparatively little agency is consistent with a more science fictional approach to the monster. So if you think about a fantasy monster, a dragon implies dragon slaying. You know, there are few stories about dragons within the Western literary tradition that are not about fighting the dragons. When you see a dragon, you think at some point, gonna fight that. Gonna slay it. I'm gonna trick it into swallowing some tar barrels and blowing up. But science fiction nods toward realism as a literary convention. So in stories like The War of the Worlds, there is heroism, of course, but it is heroism at a more human scale, whether that's acts of doom and self-sacrifice, or of protecting and preserving individuals in a, you know, heroic, compassionate way against the backdrop of a larger crisis. And so I think an extraplanar invasion could be a fun way to focus on smaller acts of heroism. This doesn't have to be extraplanar. This was actually kind of how the 5th edition campaign that I'm currently playing in began, was with the other PCs and my character as sort of young people being initiated into their tribe and their village being attacked by like an overwhelming force. There's no way that we could fight these guys, first level and all. Ultimately, our task was to take the Sacred MacGuffin and run. And so if you wanted to do that lower level story about smaller acts of heroism, about saving nice Mrs. Miggins from next door, or getting the cat, or, you know, moving some important object to safety or something like that, then an alien invasion is a fun backdrop to that because it's a little more characterful than a boring old earthquake. Now, the problem with the alien invasion story in a fantasy setting is that fantasy doesn't have the shock of the new to the same extent, right? So, the War of the Worlds happens within the context of a British Empire that is extremely confident in its own military and technological power. And that's just not going to happen in a fantasy setting. Nobody in a fantasy setting thinks that the chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one. But having weird extraplanar creatures turn up and devastate your fantasy kingdom, you know, I think they can work. Again, once. Nice way to disrupt the status quo, I suppose. Your players may feel this is a little heavy-handed, but hopefully they'll be having too much fun to really mind. I do think that you have to be careful that everyone accepts the reframing of small victories as victories. Because otherwise, players may feel that they're being kind of like railroaded into quote-unquote losing over and over. And that is essentially true. It has to be made clear that they are not losing. To save the nice old lady from next door is a victory. In terms of what monsters work well for this, I know that in the United Kingdom, everybody's favorite War of the Worlds is the Jeff Wayne version. But for me, even though I accept that it's maybe not the best version, it's the 1953 version. I was going to call it the George Pal version. Of course, Pal only produced it. Byron Haskin was the director. Everybody calls it the George Pal version. Anyway, the smooth, glossy, kind of futuristic look of those monsters, I think, is a little, like, at least on the art for the Jeff Wayne War of the Worlds, the Martian tripod almost seems at home in the technological landscape that surrounds it, whereas the sort of Martian saucer thingamajiggers in the George Pal film seem very alien compared to the kind of like Korean War era, you know, GIs and artillery pieces and whatnot posed against them, right, provides a striking contrast. So I think that when you pick your monster for your alien invasion narrative, and there's nothing wrong with having the players like defeat the occasional patrol or whatever, but I think when you want to pick your monster for that like event, you want to have something that has a similar aesthetic contrast, something that is very clearly from outside the look and feel of your fantasy world. This can be quite risky. Things that jar with an overall aesthetic sometimes are great and sometimes just feel like they don't land. Okay, my third example comes from a discussion with my wife, Allison. Allison suggested just having, like, space people as the antagonists, and I was kind of stuck for a monster. And this, I think, was a really good suggestion on her part, which is, you know, what if you have the people who would be the protagonists of a science fiction show or a science fiction story? To them, this is the story about how they crash-landed on this weird primitive world. Just humans in Silver LeMay jumpsuits with zap guns. Now, they could be pulp science fiction space imperialists, or they could be, you know, wise and empathic Jean-Luc Picard types. So the conflict could initially come from contact between these people and the locals, which could mean space imperialists, you know, coming into their village to, like, take it over. Or it could mean well-meaning weirdos coming into the village and just, like, helping themselves to all the onions because their society doesn't have money or whatever. And obviously everyone should recognize that their need is greater and just, like, confusing the heck out of everybody, right? So just, like, strange people in strange clothes appeared and started robbing the place. And when someone tried to hit him with a billhook, they stunned him. You know, and this all came after the strange lights in the sky were seen. And so in that first stage, you know, you have to go to these people and kind of figure out the root of the misunderstanding. And this is fun because, you know, most gamers like or are familiar with Star Trek. So the idea of doing, like, one of those first contact stories, you know, where the away team beams down to the planet and the planet people are all a bunch of superstitious primitives and then the Federation starts running guns to them or whatever, right? But it's that same story, but maybe being told from the other direction about the disruptive impact that these people have on the world around them. But alternatively, you know, if they are a crashed ship rather than a landing party, you could then move on to stage two, which is to have them be running from something else. And this is, you could kind of get your alien invasion story in here as well. So this is actually an escape pod or, you know, a little, like, research ship that landed after getting damaged, but they are being pursued by a more, like, fierce and warlike opponent, and that's why it's okay that they're, like, taking all the glowing rocks from the mountain. And so, like, yeah, the village wise woman needs all of these glowing rocks from the mountain to make her magic potions, but it turns out that those are the same glowing rocks that the strangers need to repair the engine in their spaceship, and they're really, you know, they're being really aggressive about it, but that's because if they don't repair the engine, then they're going to be on this planet when the Zaxxonoids catch up with them, and then the Zaxxonoids are going to conquer the planet, and they don't want that. So they're well-meaning, which in turn is actually forcing them to be a little bit aggressive. And this is actually a good way to introduce a quote-unquote alien-themed monster into your game. Like, if you haven't had Mind Flayers or Beholders in your game yet, it'd be cool to have the Zaxxonoids be Mind Flayers, right? So they're a cool alien monster because there's not that many of them. They can bring, like, other monsters under their control, so you can sort of reuse your existing cast of opponents, but they're just all telepathically brain-controlled. Or alternatively, you could introduce something completely unfamiliar. Now, when you have sci-fi guys like this, I think the temptation is to hand out lots of lightsabers and ray guns and force fields. And I think if you just have the one crashed spaceship that you're helping, then that kind of solves that problem because they wouldn't have an infinite supply of ray guns and lightsabers, you know. And maybe they have like a prime directive thing where they're not permitted to give their zap guns to people from less technologically advanced planets. Or alternatively, maybe at the end, the captain's like, "Thank you, my friends. We would not have escaped the Zaxxonoid menace without your help. As a token of the friendship between our peoples, I want to give you this force field bracelet." Or whatever, right? And then you can have like a cool magic item that comes from them. And if you want to keep the number of lootable magic items limited from the Zaxxonoid perspective, you could do the whole biological alien blah 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 bit and have them be sort of tyrannid, like the biological guns and biological whatever that all are connected to their Zaxxonoid anatomy. Or they could be, you know, luminous energy beings a la Star Trek. For the biological ones, the Hive Brood would be a pretty good set of monsters there, actually. Although To really get a good hive brood story, you sort of want them to have been in an area for a while, because all that stuff about their reproductive cycle is going to work better when it's had time to happen. But it's actually a lot of monsters in the creature catalog that would be suitable for this kind of thing. I feel like the incidence of science fantasy monsters in the creature catalog is pretty high compared to other D&D monster books, and has the added benefit that, particularly in this day and age, you know, I think at the time that the creature catalog came out, you'd have a lot of people who would have played some of these scenarios, and therefore some of these creature catalog monsters would have been old hat to them. But I feel like a lot of those scenarios that kind of fall into the tiers below the real classics are not necessarily well remembered today. You know, few people are like, oh yeah, Drums on Fire Mountain, I know that one, in the way that they might feel about Night's Dark Terror or The Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh. I love saying The Sinister Secret of Saltmarsh, don't you? It's like saying The Startling Saga of the Silver Surfer. I mean, my show is called Monster Man, and I wrote a book called The Pamphlet of Pantheons. You can tell I like alliteration. Anyway, so those are, I think, three good ways to incorporate sci-fi quote-unquote monsters, even though the third one's not necessarily a monster, and arguably neither's the first, into your fantasy role-playing games. It's a tricky thing because there are... I find that a lot of players like the genre flexibility that a D&D game brings you. So if you're playing a series of picaresque fantasy wanderers, this kind of happens in my post-apocalyptic game as well, right? You'll rock up into a new location, and that almost kind of brings with it a new genre. Like, oh, we're doing a haunted house. Oh, we're doing a murder mystery. Oh, we're doing a Seven Samurai. And I feel like there's a spot where when you go, oh, we're doing an alien invasion. Like, some groups will be okay with that. But some groups turned up to the heroic fantasy quests table because they like heroic fantasy quests, and that's what they like. And even if they do like cozy murder mysteries, they don't like them in their heroic fantasy quests and vice versa, presumably. So you gotta know your players. I mean, that's true of everything, but I think especially when you're messing with genre, which means you are messing with the fundamentals of the game, you have to have a good feeling about how your players will react. I think in a one-off, almost nobody minds. But in a campaign, it's not so much that you are introducing a new genre as that you are introducing the idea that the campaign is variable genres, and that can make some people uncomfortable. So that's my little caveat. All right, that's about all the time that I have to talk about using sci-fi monsters in your fantasy games for today. Robert, I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and thank you once again for your support. If you'd like to be like Robert and get your own special episode, remember, patreon.com/monsterman, $5 level. But if you'd like to support the show in other ways, why not leave a rating or review on the podcasting app of your choice? Or just tell a friend who you think might like it. In our next episode, we're going from high tech to low tech as we take a look at the people whose hard work underlies every, or at least theoretically every, fantasy game, the peasants. All of that right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.